Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, as the government auctions thousands of acres of ocean off of Martha's Vineyard for wind power, local fishermen say they're getting a raw deal.
When windmills plant themselves on the bottom of the ocean, especially in large groups, that will end commercial fishing in New England. That will destroy the commercial fishing industry as it exists today.
Also today, why Framingham officials felt there was no other way to solve their beaver problem other than killing them.
I feel like there's definitely places you could find a home for these beavers that you wouldn't have to kill them.
And a local educator on the history of gay rights in Massachusetts schools and the impact of teachers coming out.
If you do this, you're going to be saving lives. I think you can have a bigger conversation or a bigger impact on your students than that.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Let's begin today at sea, where nearly 400,000 acres of prime ocean real estate are being auctioned off this afternoon. On offer, three parcels of offshore wind projects. At last check, some 19 bidders are competing for leases, with the top bid at $271 per acre. Now, that's quite a change from 3 years ago when the federal government tried to auction off four nearby watery parcels. The top bid back then was $1.50 per acre, and two of the parcels got no bids at all. So what's changed? For one, the state's mandate of 1,600 megawatts of wind power, and there's better technology to deliver it. But even before today's auction, other plans to develop offshore wind power have had fishermen up in arms. And joining us now to talk about all this is Rich Fuca. He's a fisherman and president of the Rhode Island Fishermen's Alliance. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Yeah, good afternoon, Jamie, and thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. Also with us in the studio here is Elizabeth Turnbull-Henry. She's president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Good to see you.
Thank you, Jamie.
So I want to start with Vineyard Wind. It's a company. It's one of today's bidders. It's, you know, proposing a project on one of the watery parcels that's already been auctioned off. But what's the current project there that has some in the fishing industry upset? Can you just start by explaining what that project would look like and what it would do?
Would you prefer ladies before gentlemen?
No, Elizabeth, that's to you.
Oh, that's to me. Great. Sure. So Vineyard Wind won a contract with the state to build 800 megawatts of offshore wind. To put this in context, that's about 84 huge turbines out about 14 miles off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. That's, if you're standing on land, you won't be able to see them. They're quite far away. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine Cape Wind in your mind, I would ask you to scratch that image. These are over the lip of the horizon, really.
And Cape Wind, of course, is
the infamous
failed project off the coast of the Cape.
Right. And what was interesting, no one really knew where these projects were going to come in terms of cost to the ratepayers, but Vineyard Wind's project surprised many of us who watch the industry. They will be providing energy at 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour. So compare that to power that was in the low to mid 20s for Cape Wind. So we're looking at essentially a 75% reduction in cost relative to what we thought we would be paying 10 years ago.
So a big change.
A big change.
It would represent four ratepayers.
Right. This is a big industrial wind project that is that's pretty cost effective.
So then, Rich, for you as a fisherman, I mean, what's your concern about these huge turbines out in the water, as Elizabeth describes them?
Well, first and foremost, and good afternoon, Elizabeth. Pleasure to be on with you.
We'd like to keep it cordial here. Thank you, Rich.
I would argue the numbers on the per kilowatt delivered land side, but my big fear is, and this is what commercial fishermen and taxpayers are just starting to wake up to, is the fact of what we're going to trade a quote-unquote green energy for a food source. And what I mean by that is what actually physically happens to the bottom of the ocean once these windmills are placed on the bottom is something that's going to continue to destroy the bottom from all types of different sources, one being the towers themselves, the currents that are changed in and around the farms, around the structures themselves, which creates bottom scour, which is going to destroy some very sensitive fish bottom. That's where the fishermen in Rhode Island come in, because we're giving up some very lucrative, very sensitive squid bottom in these areas. The electromagnetic fields that are emitted off of these towers, whether it's on the bottom or from the windmill blades, there's a whole host of things that are going to happen that hasn't been proven in this country yet, simply because we don't have them in this country. So I also want to say that fishermen today, the fishermen that exist today, and especially a very sensitive place like Massachusetts, they've been part of the fabric there for hundreds of years. These folks, this industry is so green. We've been made into such a perfectly green molded harvester that I even kid people and say, listen, these guys celebrate St. Patty's Day every day. They're so green. But the point is simply this. They tend to their nets, they tend to their business in extremely sustainable ways. So they have a dog in the fight in keeping the ocean thriving and lucrative in an environmental way.
And Rich, I mean, we've done numerous stories on this show and on WBUR about how the fishermen of New England are up against it, both because of climate change and also other environmental and economic factors. And so, Elizabeth, I'm just wondering if you could respond to some of the points that Rich made there, because there will be impacts of having these massive structures out in the ocean.
There will be. And developers like Vineyard Wind need to make sure that they do this right, right? They need to consider the right whales, the fishermen, birds, ratepayers. But what I think we've seen from decades of deployment at offshore wind in Europe, that it is possible for thriving offshore wind and healthy fisheries to coexist. And I see no reason why we can't do that in Massachusetts.
But should we just be leaving it to the developers to get it right? Shouldn't the government or someone other agency, shouldn't there be rules in place to make sure that this is a good process both for the fishermen and for the ratepayers?
I mean, there have been, I think, over 100 stakeholder meetings. I mean, this conversation is playing out very much in the public domain.
So then, Rich, what would you like to see happen here?
Well, first and foremost, I want to respond to the success overseas, which is simply not the case with the fishermen. If you want to see how badly the fisheries has been destroyed overseas, I suggest you go join the Dutch fishermen and see where they stand on this topic of windmills on their fishing grounds, and which we've had fisheries liaisons actually do that. But
Rich, we don't even have to go there. We can we have, five turbines off the coast of Block Island as they're there now as a test project. So what are you seeing there?
Well, they have done very little studying because those windmills have only been there for 5-6 years. So they've got 4 or 5 years of studies in and around the windmills prior to the windmills being activated. And now that the windmills have been activated, and there are only 5 windmills. There's been proof of and sign of a negative response to lobsters going into traps, fish disappearing in the areas. That's just a small precursor to what we're gambling with off our New England coast.
But how much do you think that is or could be attributed to rising water temperatures or, there's numerous reports out? One from the Gulf of Maine saying that lobsters are moving further north.
None of it. That's a great question, Jamie, because I've heard even National Marine Fisheries Service argue that the studying that's done, whether it's collaboratively with the fishing industry or in and around or with the National Marine Fisheries research vessels like the Bigelow, they're going to be restricted in not being able to survey the areas in and around the farms themselves. So, the changing climate has actually created a situation in Rhode Island waters where we actually have codfish that have moved off of Georgia's banks into Rhode Island waters. So, mm-hmm. I don't want I don't want your listeners to think that, that everything is moving east and north. That's just simply not the case. We've had some very lucrative cod fishing in our own state waters where we haven't had it over the past. So,
but I guess the overarching point is that things are changing in the oceans.
Yes, absolutely. But my big concern is why aren't environmentalists understanding that putting a man-made structure in the water isn't gonna expedite some sort of environmental change? That's the alarming thing here. You'd be hard pressed to find a fisherman in any port that is against windmills. They're gonna first thing out of their mouth is gonna be, well, why don't they just put them on land? It makes much more sense. You can get to them easier. They're easier to maintain. Putting them in the ocean and sacrificing the bottom of the ocean is something that needs to be slowed down.
Well, Elizabeth, respond to that. I mean, you know,
we're moving too quickly. I'm a firm believer of facts, and I want somebody to prove to the fishermen of New England, in fact, the entire East Coast, because windmills are slated to pop up all up and down the eastern seaboard.
Rich, we've got it. Unfortunately, we're tight on time here, so I do want to give Elizabeth a chance to respond here. So,
sure.
Rich, you put a lot of things on the table there, including this idea that, you know, maybe this is moving too quickly. Why is it moving so quickly? Or do you think it's moving quickly?
Well, Rich, I just first want to say I agree that New England is home to a really proud, iconic fishing industry. And I don't think anyone is here to take that away from, you know, you or your community. I will also say that New England faces a profound economic and environmental opportunity with offshore wind, and it is a kind of a once in a generation opportunity, and one that I think Massachusetts and Rhode Island, Connecticut, all up and down the East Coast would be impoverished if we dismissed. Consider that the BOEM process unfolding today.
And that's the auction
which
process.
Which is the auction process, thank you, to auction three additional parcels of ocean floor. When you combine those three parcels with the three that we already have, if we were to build out all of those parcels with turbines using today's technology, never mind what's coming down the pike, we could power every home in New England, every home in Massachusetts with carbon-free power, and do so at a net savings to the ratepayers. I think that's pretty exciting. We've been at the end of the pipeline for gas and oil for a long time, and we have the potential to be at the beginning of our own pipeline and powering ourselves and employing folks around New England.
Well, I hope that, you know, we can come to a compromise here. Unfortunately, we're out of time on this conversation. The last word there was from Elizabeth Turnbull Henry. She's president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Jamie.
And
Thank you, Jamie.
With us is Rich Fuga. He's a fisherman and president of the Rhode Island Fishermen's Alliance. Rich, thank you. And again, I really hope that we can come to a compromise on this, okay?
I think we need to slow down, Jamie, and take our time with this. Thank you very much.
We'll do more on this coming up. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. We're going to go now to Framingham, where city officials are confirming to Radio Boston that they have successfully trapped and killed beavers in two locations where their dams caused water to flood and freeze on roads, posing a public safety threat. And because state law prohibits transporting beavers to different locations, the city says they had no choice but to set lethal traps. Joining us now on the line to talk about this is Jeff Collins. He's the director of conservation science for Mass Audubon. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Jamie. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
So first, you know, this story has kind of developed through the day. We just confirmed here on our show that these beavers have been killed. So what's your reaction to that news?
Well, I think, first off, Framingham, I'm sure, is not alone in facing this issue. We've worked with folks in Framingham on their conservation commission and their staff there, and they're good people. They've partnered with us on conservation issues, and I think that a lot of towns are going to be facing this situation where you have a sort of a short-term public safety issue, but there's a need to look at longer-term solutions to addressing conflicts with beavers, flooding, and other wildlife.
So these were real issues that Framingham was facing, and I think it's easy to feel for the animals, but it's also we should feel for the people too. They were trying to figure out what the best thing was to do for their city. So Have they solved the problem by killing these beavers?
In the short term, I think they'll be able to drain, you know, the wetland or lower the wetland to relieve flooding on that road, et cetera. But the beavers were there because it was attractive habitat for them. So in short order, other beavers will be back. Beavers reproduce. The young eventually move off and find their own habitat. And someone will be back rebuilding that dam pretty soon. And so that raises the need to use other methods to coexist with wildlife. And in the case of beavers on Mass Audubon Wildlife Sanctuaries, we've used a device called a beaver deceiver, and this has been successful in a lot of other places.
What's a beaver deceiver?
You basically put a pipe through the dam, and then you block off the inlet of that pipe so that the beavers can't figure out where the dam is leaking, and they won't go back and close up the pipe. So beavers will respond to the sound of flowing water. They'll just instinctively pull over some sticks and material and mud, block that up, slow down the flow, and build up their pond. So if you can basically secretly and quietly punch a hole in the dam, sometimes they can't quite figure it out. Those devices, there's some cost involved planning.
Yeah, I mean, how much does something like that cost to do?
Some maintenance, but they're successful.
How much does a beaver deceiver, is that really the name of it? It sounds interesting.
There's a capital B, capital B. I think there's a
product. Oh, so it's a company. Okay.
Beaver deceiver, but there are others, you know, kind of you can come up with a similar device. Cost-wise.
Yeah, how much does something like that cost? Yeah.
Staffing, et cetera, probably in the thousands of dollars. I think the situation in Framingham was it was a time issue probably more than a resource issue.
Yeah, and the city of Framingham actually said that to us in a statement. They said, at this point, due to the extreme elevation of the water, it was too late to implement that option. But so putting the beaver deceiver or other similar devices aside, were there other ways that the city could have dealt with this? We were reading that it's against state law to move beavers. Why is that?
That's right. Yeah, it's not only the case in Massachusetts, and that law has been in place for a long time. I think the concern there is that you are, you're moving wildlife. You could be spreading disease or parasites to other populations. You're sort of dropping off this one animal where there's other animals already present, leading to conflicts. You drop, kick that animal out of the back of the car, and then it's a stranger in a new land. It doesn't know what to do, where to go. It's not very kind to that animal. You're not dealing with the problem, as we just talked about. You're making it someone else's problem, potentially. So you can not relocate animals off of your own property.
Got it. So, one other question on this before we run out of time here. Are there other species that maybe could be introduced to the area, or other environmental things that could be done in Framingham, other towns, to help control the beaver population?
Beavers are so successful because they've got a great strategy figured out. They make their pond, mm-hmm. they stay in the water, they get their food in the now flooded area, and they were successful even in the age of our big predators, wolves and mountain lions. But they had a strategy that protected them. So they don't really have effective predators at this point. I will just finally say, if I have time, to say this is an issue that's going to be more common, I think, in an era of climate change. We're going to have more precipitation, uh-huh. more intense rain events. And beaver dams and other wetlands are actually acting as sponges, absorbing that stormwater.
So they're important to the ecosystem.
They're important, and I think they're going to be more important going forward.
All right. Well, we'll keep on this one. Jeff Collins is the Director of Conservation Science for Mass Audubon. Jeff, thanks for helping us make a little bit more sense of what happened in Framingham.
Good to talk to you, Jamie.
It was a lunchtime argument among East Boston high school students that quickly fizzled, but what transpired in the cafeteria that day set a series of actions in motion, and 3 years later, the repercussions are still unfolding. WBUR's Shannon Dooling brings us this report, Observations of a Seemingly Mundane High School Argument That Can Have a Profound Impact in the Hands of Federal Immigration Officials. Her story begins in El Salvador.
The small city of Metepan is about a 2-hour drive from the Salvadoran capital of San Salvador, It's close to the border with Guatemala. This is where we meet 22-year-old Orlando. It's a hot and humid afternoon, and he wipes sweat from his forehead every now and then. He says it's safer for us to talk at the plaza instead of meeting him at his grandparents' house.
So you've been back here since January. What is life like here?
Life here is really hard. I can't find a job here. There's nothing. It's really dangerous. There's too much death here and fear. There's a lot of fear.
We've agreed to use only his middle name. Orlando fears for his safety in El Salvador and for the safety of his grandparents. Orlando was born in Metepan, but it's never really felt like home. He says he was abandoned by his mother when he was younger and was more or less raising himself much of his life. And that's why he decided to find his dad. He was 17 when he started the journey alone, heading north toward the U.S.-Mexico border and ultimately East Boston.
It was awful. I had to travel by land, and it was hard. There was a lot of suffering. I was mistreated a lot along the way.
He says he was kidnapped in Mexico and held hostage for almost a month before he escaped, illegally crossing the border near McAllen, Texas. He arrived as an unaccompanied minor in 2014 and was released to his father in Boston. He obtained a special immigrant juvenile visa and applied for a green card. He was working and going to school. He says he felt safe in Boston.
I don't know. I guess I got used to being with my family. That's what I wanted the most.
And then, in 2015, on a Thursday afternoon in November, all of that changed.
So as you can see, there's a number of files and folders. You can also see FedEx envelopes that included filings to the Board of Immigration Appeals.
Sarah Sherman Stokes opens the top drawer of a filing cabinet in her Boston University Law School office. Sherman Stokes represented Orlando in his immigration proceedings. She thumbs through dozens of folders, all related to Orlando's case.
I mean, it does feel in some ways like this sort of tomb where all the papers came to die.
Two of these papers, an incident report filed by an East Boston high school police officer, triggered what comes next. The report cited what began as a few students heckling another student in a classroom. The class dismisses and moves into the cafeteria for lunch, at which point a few of the students confront one another. What follows is described in the report as an unsuccessful attempt at starting a fight. One student is cited as saying he heard from friends that some of the young people involved might be part of a gang. According to the report, school police officers reviewed security camera footage. Orlando was identified as one of the students involved. In the report, he's listed as an associate of the gang MS-13. The incident description ends stating, quote, "This incident will also be sent to the BRIC." That's the Boston Regional Intelligence Center. It's a unit of the Boston Police Department that gathers and analyzes intelligence, which is shared with federal law enforcement. 9 months later, Orlando was getting ready to go to work at a nearby Mexican restaurant when he was arrested at his father's home by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. That two-page school incident report had made its way into what's known as a gang packet, information compiled by Homeland Security Investigations, or HSI. It's unclear how, but Orlando allegedly evolved, in the eyes of authorities, into a verified and active member of MS-13. Those were the classifications printed in all capital letters on the first page of the government's gang packet. Here's Sherman Stokes.
The maker of this report is usually a special agent from HSI, and that person's usually not available in court to be cross-examined. One of the problems here is it's a black box. You know, it's not clear to us how this determination that the client is a verified and active member of a street gang, how is that determination made?
The government's case also included pictures printed off Orlando's Facebook account. Handwritten notes in the margins and arrows point to details like blue shoelaces and a Chicago Bulls hat as alleged proof of MS-13 affiliation. Orlando, for his part, insists he was never involved with the gang. Sherman Stokes says he has no criminal record. Around this time, East Boston and neighboring communities were experiencing a spike in violent crimes believed to be associated with organized gang activity. Many of the victims were young men of Central American backgrounds. In January 2016, federal, state, and local law enforcement made arrests throughout Greater Boston, leading to a sweeping indictment of more than 60 alleged MS-13 members and associates. Just last month, one of the members was sentenced to life in connection with the killings of two teenagers in East Boston. The victims had been stabbed dozens of times. Orlando's school incident report was sent to the BRIC by a Boston school police sergeant. According to a transcript of immigration court testimony, the officer says he received no specialized training in identifying gang activity, but has learned how to identify gang behavior after years on the job. He goes on to testify that keeping track of gang behavior is a big part of his duties at East Boston High School. School police officers are employees of Boston Public Schools, not the Boston Police Department. In an email, a Boston Public Schools spokesman said the Boston Police Department provides regular training to school police officers on gang activity. Thomas Nolan is a former Boston Police gang detective and a professor of criminology. He says he's concerned Boston school police officers are performing more like Boston police, but without the proper training.
Boston school police are putting in information into the BRIC database that's oftentimes not only inaccurate, but they're exceeding the bounds of their authority.
Nolan also worked for the Department of Homeland Security, the federal agency overseeing regional intelligence centers like the BRIC. He's traveled around the country training law enforcement on the kind of information that should be shared in these databases. We showed him the school incident report alleging Orlando's gang association and describing the incident in the cafeteria.
Well, someone receiving this kind of information at the BRIC needs to make an assessment as to whether or not this is appropriately included in the criminal intelligence database. And if this was something that I saw, I would never put this into a criminal intelligence database.
The Boston Police Department did not respond to requests for comment. Some Boston school police have exercised their authority off school property, which, according to Boston Public School officials, is beyond school police jurisdiction. Six students listed in a Boston School Police intelligence report obtained by WBUR were stopped and frisked in 2017 by Boston School Police at a dog park in East Boston. The intelligence report was included in one of the federal government's gang packets. It was filed by the same sergeant who alleged Orlando was a gang associate. Nolan now does some work as an analyst, evaluating information for immigration attorneys whose clients have gang packets. He questions whether city leaders are fully aware of the way information flows between Boston school police and federal immigration officials.
This city, Boston, represents itself as a sanctuary city. It certainly conveys the idea that its law enforcement agency will not cooperate and facilitate deportations and ICE detentions, when in fact the Boston Regional Intelligence Center is doing just that.
WBUR submitted repeated public information requests to Boston Public Schools, asking for details about training for school police and other incident reports that included gang allegations. Despite winning an appeal from the state records office, WBUR received a response from the city of Boston saying the records are part of active litigation and would not be made available. The ACLU of Massachusetts recently sued the Boston Police Department, asking for access to the gang database and citing an uptick in gang allegations being used to keep people in detention and, in some cases, as a basis for deportation. After spending more than a year detained in immigration custody in Boston, Orlando signed his own deportation letter in 2017 against the advice of his lawyer. He says he was too depressed to wait out the appeals process behind bars. Sitting in Metepan, Orlando stares out into the plaza, reflecting on his life in Boston.
Working and studying and everything. I was doing all that when they grabbed me. My life was ruined. And truthfully, I don't know if I'm ever going to have another opportunity like that.
Orlando is still adjusting to his surroundings in El Salvador. He's looking for work, but says he spends most days in the house, just sort of passing time.
That report from WBUR's Shannon Dooling. Stay with us. There's more Radio Boston after the break. I'm Jamie Bologna. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. At its most basic level, going to school is supposed to feel safe, an environment that allows kids to grow, thrive, and build friendships, maybe even learn a thing or two. And sure, school can also be a tough place for all types of students, but for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or questioning students, school can be a true nightmare, facing bullying, exclusion, and in some cases, physical harm. LGBTQ students can also feel that they have nowhere to go for support. But in a new book out from Concord Carlisle High School teacher Stephen Lane, he argues about a courageous grassroots group of students, teachers, and even politicians here in Massachusetts who try to change that and how the entire country thinks about supporting gay youth at school. Lane teaches social studies in his book, and his book is No Sanctuary, Teachers and the School Reform That Brought Gay Rights to the Masses. Stephen, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Jamie. It's great to be here.
And I want to throw the number out there for our listeners to call in, and because I want to invite them into this conversation to see if anyone out there is LGBTQ or have family or friends who are in the community and what their experiences were as a student or a teacher in a school. What do you think schools should be doing to better protect all students? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or we're on Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Stephen, help us set the scene a little bit, because you have in this book such a beautiful history of the gay rights movement, of Massachusetts' role in that. And so can you just take us back to the 80s and the experience of LGBTQ students and faculty in Massachusetts?
That's a good question. I wouldn't want to speak for everybody, but
sure.
I think the predominant thing that I heard was a sense of isolation, a sense of often feeling that you were the only gay or lesbian person in the school, in the community. And the messages you heard from the outside world is that what you were was shameful, was to be suppressed or, if possible, honestly eliminated. And so having nowhere to turn and hearing only these messages, I think left students feeling particularly alone and in despair. So I think the mission, the mission of schools to maybe counteract those messages was one that schools weren't really addressing at all.
So what fascinated me about your book was I didn't know that Massachusetts was sort of on these front lines on this issue. Can you just give us a little bit of that story of how Massachusetts led the way? I know it wasn't maybe the first or most welcoming place, but
no, I think you're right. I hesitate to talk about firsts too much in the
book
because there are a lot of threads and a lot of things happening at the same time. But Massachusetts, I think, started the movement that resonated with other places and with other states, and there's sort of a fortunate confluence of political events, as you mentioned, but also some truly courageous and effective educators who were able to bring their school communities and eventually the whole state along with them in this quest to support LGBTQ youth.
And so who were some of these people?
So Arthur Lipkin, who I think we'll hear from in a minute. I think there should be a statue of Arthur somewhere in Cambridge. But he staged a walkout in Cambridge that brought the issue of safety for LGBTQ youth to the attention in Cambridge. Bob Parlin is a teacher still teaching at Newton South High School and is someone just able to bring people along with him and change behavior in ways that doesn't put people on the defensive. And, you know, even students as well. The student who created the first Gay Straight Alliance at Phillips Andover Academy, I mean, she's a 16-year-old girl. And in many ways, she's taking on the 1,200-plus population of students at Andover, the faculty, alumni. And I can't imagine the courage and poise that took as a student to try to bring such change to your community. But they all, in their ways, were tremendously effective.
So you mentioned Arthur, mm-hmm. and I want to go to him in just a second here. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, you're talking about some of these schools, and you mm-hmm. you write about them in the book as well: Concord Academy, Phillips Academy, Andover, Newton South, Cambridge, where Arthur Lipkin was a teacher, mm-hmm. and I mean, these are places of incredible privilege, and I'm just wondering how that fits into this story.
I that's an excellent point, and I think there's something to that having a movement led by predominantly white men. Made it a little bit easier, perhaps, for them to act, and perhaps that's something that I think the LGBTQ movement still needs to address is expanding their tent, as it were, to include everybody in the LGBTQ community. So,
well, let's hear from Arthur sure. Lipkin because. As you mentioned, he was directly involved in this effort early on. He's one of the first openly gay teachers in Massachusetts, and he led efforts to create a safe environment for LGBTQ faculty and youth at Cambridge Ridge and Latin School in the 80s. Arthur, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Jamie.
First, can I just ask, did you know when you came out what was going to happen?
No, not entirely. I grew up in Cambridge. I was born here. I was a product of the public schools, and nothing that preceded my coming out gave me any idea what kind of reception I would get.
And so tell us about that reception.
In terms of my personal acceptance, I had a very easy time with students. And just a couple of faculty members gave me a rough time. One in particular was egregious in some of the things he said to students about me, and I had to complain about that a couple of times. And finally, I told the principal that I would be at home until he could guarantee a safe environment. It took me a month to be given a hearing, really, and I regretted missing out on teaching, but ultimately a bunch of us had been pressing for some professional development around issues of sexuality, and we met resistance even in privileged Cambridge, and it was the settlement of my complaint against my colleague that led the school department finally to have a session for the entire faculty. At which I didn't speak, actually, because I was, I think, thought of as a bit of a bomb tosser, so I thought it would be better to have some more conservative folks speak up that day and some former students speak up, and it was a transformative event.
So what year are we talking about here?
God, you would have to ask that of a 72-year-old. I think it was the early 80s.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, were you afraid?
Well, I had been through trials of other kinds at the school regarding being a teacher who took a prominent role in fighting for racial justice. And when I first started teaching in 68, speaking up about military recruiting and the war and that war in Vietnam and so forth. And even though I was a native Cantabrigian from a working class family, I was sort of labeled a radical. So I'd been through some trials over those kinds of stands that I took. And I felt as if this was just a completing of the fight that I had been waging for a number of years.
And so, Stephen, you mentioned Arthur mm-hmm. both here and in the book, and, yeah. and I'm curious from your perspective as a historian, as someone who's written this book, what his experience and other experiences of teachers and students maybe taught us, or what we learned coming out of what they did. What came of it?
Well, I think to my mind, there's maybe two things, and one is, as you mentioned in the intro, that schools do a lot more than just teach academic content. Maybe more than anything else, we try to instill and model values. And so when you have teachers like Arthur who are openly gay and unafraid of that, I think that sends a different message from the typical stereotype that students would ever see to that point. And so I think that's a really significant takeaway from the book, is that teachers like that can matter. And maybe the other thing is that in this fight, the most effective political activists were the students. They were the true drivers of change. And I think that's an important lesson maybe for students today, is to recognize that they do have tremendous power mm-hmm. as youth.
And is that different from other movements in the past? I mean, I'm thinking of the civil rights movement mm-hmm. or even here in Boston and busing and other education-related changes. Did you think, was this an anomaly for students to be the ones, students and teachers to be the ones driving this?
That's a great question. I think, throughout a lot of progressive movements, the youth have played a massive role in bringing change. At the same time, I think it's a useful reminder from time to time. I will say that the traditional narrative on school reform is that it is a top-down process, and that you have progressive ideas coming from various places that are implemented in schools by administrators, politicians, reformers, and that teachers are cast in the role of obstacles to reform. And I don't know, maybe Arthur can speak to this. That has not been my experience as a teacher, and so I think the other lesson here is that there's a tremendous amount of important progressive reform in schools that comes from the bottom up, that comes from students and teachers, and we'd be wise to pay attention to that.
I just want to remind our listeners, we're talking with Stephen Lane. He is a high school teacher at Concord Carlisle. His new book is No Sanctuary, Teachers and the School Reform That Brought Gay Rights to the Masses. Our phone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If you have any stories or experiences as a student or a teacher in the schools here in Massachusetts and what you think the school should be doing to protect all students, give us a call. Arthur, Stephen mentioned you here, and I just would like for you to have a moment there to react with your experience in the schools.
Well, I'll say that shortly after my coming out, the governor at the time, Bill Weld, had a great idea to form a commission on LGBT youth and seek public input, much of which came from students. And the State Student Advisory Council, which was a representative group from students across the state that meet regularly at the Department of Education, lobbied for a student rights bill that would be inclusive of sexual orientation. That since has been expanded to gender identity. And so I would second what Stephen has to say about student voices having a strong impact. But I'd also warn that we shouldn't rest on our laurels and think that Massachusetts is always in the vanguard, because back when the governor's commission reported to Governor Weld, one of their recommendations was that there be books in the library and there be representation of LGBT people in the curriculum. And neither one of those recommendations was accepted by the governor, forwarded to the Department of Ed or the Board of Ed. We had to wait 20 years before, just a few years ago, the curriculum and library pieces were added. And the curriculum is still in the works. We're waiting for approval from the Department of Ed to start to make those kinds of inclusive units available in the schools. I've been working on that really hard. Mm-hmm. So we've got work to do, and we will depend on students and their parents and families to support that.
At the same time, Stephen, though, I can't help but note that it was a Republican governor in Massachusetts that did this.
Oh, it was a Republican governor, and Bill Weld, for whatever you think of him, took a fairly courageous stand at the time on this issue, and was supported overwhelmingly by LGBTQ voters in Massachusetts. And I think he belonged to a strain of socially progressive, economically conservative Republicanism that seems to have gone the way of the dinosaur. And I would add to it one thing that Arthur said that I think is important, is that this fight by no means has been won. You know, the risks facing LGBTQ youth are still unconscionably high, and so there's still much work to be done on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, we were reading a report just out this summer from Boston Indicators of the Boston Foundation Fenway Institute that found among Massachusetts youth in the LGBTQ community, almost 50% have considered suicide. That's mm-hmm. compared to 11% in the mm-hmm. general population, and mm-hmm. a quarter actually attempted mm-hmm. suicide compared to 5% in the general yeah. population. And that's not much better than federal numbers back from 1985.
No, that's correct. And so there, I think in some areas we've been successful. And as that points out very starkly, there is a lot that still we need to do. And what Arthur talks about, including more positive imagery and stories in the curriculum, I think is very important.
So, Stephen, you're still a teacher. I know,
correct.
Arthur, you are not. But, mm-hmm. but Stephen, at Concord Carlisle High School and mm-hmm. Going around with your book, mm-hmm. What are you hearing from young people on this?
Mm-hmm. A whole lot of things. And I will say that Arthur, I know, can speak to this as well, because he's been researching. He's been speaking to a lot of gay, straight, or gender sexuality alliances now. But what I hear when I speak to students is some encouraging things that they by and large feel supported by administrators and supported in the communities, but also there's an energy and a desire to do more, to see some changes, particularly now around gender identity, mm-hmm. Whether it's pronoun use in schools or what what labels are on the bathrooms and issues like this, and those types of things, which seem relatively minor to many of us, make a big difference. They send a huge message on where a school stands and how a school is supporting their population. So,
but there has been, and you write about mm-hmm. it in your book, there's a history of pushback against some of these initiatives.
Absolutely.
And even, there's a situation with a transgender principal in Swampscott earlier this year. And so mm-hmm. I'm wondering from you, Stephen, what can be done to counter that?
Well, that if we knew the answer, it would have been done already. I think that this may sound very pat, but a lot of the success of the early movement was very successful education and keeping the focus on what kids need to feel supported and safe and to be successful in schools. And so I think that general approach of keeping the focus on what students need, it's awfully hard for most people to be against student safety. It's awfully hard for people to argue that students shouldn't feel supported attending school, as you say. So I think that needs to be the focus. What the particular methods are for addressing these new issues, I'm probably not the best guy to say. Arthur's is far more experienced and better activist than I, and he may have some ideas, but...
Arthur,
well,
got an idea?
I would jump in just to go back to something you said before about the improvement in the suicide attempts and even follow-through statistics that we are now looking at over a 30-year period almost. The numbers for LGBT students have improved somewhat. But the gap between the risks in substance use, in depression, suicide attempt, and so forth, the gaps are still there between those students and their straight peers. And among the LGBT students, those students of color are at greater risk than their gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender peers who are white. So the discrepancies there, the disparities are distressing, and we've been working on this for a long time, and I would hope to see even more progress as we go ahead.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, Arthur, we're short on time here, but a very important point. That's Arthur Lipkin. He's one of the first openly gay teachers in Massachusetts. And also with us was Stephen Lane. He's the author of No Sanctuary: Teachers and the School Reform That Brought Gay Rights to the Masses. Stephen, thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Radio Boston for today. I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again tomorrow.